Tonight on Arena, the RTÉ Short Story Competition. We get a flavour of all 10 shortlisted stories and the judges announce the overall winner. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTÉ Arena. And tonight we dedicate ourselves to the art of the short story, more specifically the RTÉ Short Story Competition. Later in the show, I'll be joined by the three members of the judging panel, writers Lisa McInerney, Declan Hughes and Lucy Caldwell, to talk about the shortlist of 10. I'll be talking to some of the shortlisted authors about their work. And just before the end of the show this evening, we will be revealing the winners of the first, second and third prizes in this year's competition. But to start, I want to talk just a little bit about the short story as a form in and of itself with two people who certainly know a thing or two about short stories, writer and novelist Kevin Barry and Chris Morrish of the Department of English in TC. Let's start with the man who's given us three collections of short stories and won more than a few prizes for his efforts in that particular form. What makes a good story a good short story for you, Kevin? Kevin Barry. What makes a good story a good short story for you, Kevin? Kevin Barry.
I think, Sean, what I look for when I read a story or when I write one is a strong measure of intensity. And intensity can take different forms. It might be a story that delivers hysterical comic intensity or a story that gives you an intensely poignant note. But whatever it is, what you're looking for is a real transmission of feeling from the page. And I think a great story is one that insinuates its way into your memory as if you'd formed it yourself, as if the events of the story had happened to you yourself.
And I suppose it has to have that kind of succinctness that you've just given us in that answer, Kevin. Intensity, that's a very important aspect for sure. Chris, what makes the good short story for you?
Yeah, I think Kevin sums it up well there. It's distillation is the word I would use. I suppose the way I think of it is, say you compare the short story to the novel, you know, it's like the difference between beer and whiskey. You know, when you're making whiskey, you make this thing called green beer, which is a kind of brewed thing you make with the malt. And then you boil it and you let it condense and you boil it and you let it condense. And what had been a great big vat of this green beer, this mash, ends up as the pure drop. And in some ways, the short story is the whiskey of the literary world.
I suppose, Kevin, having written a few novels yourself as well, the idea that you might write a novel and edit and distill it down into a short story, that would be pretty exhausting. But is there a relationship there between the novel form and the short story form? What is that relationship?
Yeah, I think it's and I think the pure drop is a good way to put it. I think what the story can do that the novel can't do really is it can go absolutely full throttle from the off. I think a novel needs often its quieter moments. It needs its kind of a looser feeling in places. It needs to relax in places. Whereas a story can be stretched out on a very kind of a taut wire all the way through. And again, it can give you that distilled essence of feeling or that intensity again.
Yeah, and I've spoken to more than one writer, Chris, who has said to me, you know, this started as a short story and then grew into a novel, which there is sometimes this sense that somehow the short story is the lesser form and when it grows up, it'll become a novel.
Yeah, certainly that does happen. But I think it's a bit of a misconception because, like, we know, for instance, like Mary Lavin, the great Irish short story writer Mary Lavin, in her papers, there are drafts of her short stories that are like over 100 pages with like 8-9 characters. Mm. And then when you get the short story, it's 20 pages and somebody that just happens to walk by the back of a field somewhere has had a whole chapter in the longer version. So it can work both ways, I think.
Yeah, so it's not a one-way relationship. No. But I'm guessing, Kevin, the process of writing a short story, the presumption might be that it's, well, you sit down and you do that over a couple of weeks and it's a shorter process for sure than the much longer process of writing a novel. Not necessarily an easier thing to write in the shorter form than to write in the longer form.
Yeah, I think as a practitioner, it's a sort of form that you definitely kind of earn your luck in. the more you chance your arm at them, the more likely you are to find a bit of luck and to make, like a lot of the stories that I've written that are my among my favorites, I would say I've written inside a week or two, that they've been very quick and they've come more or less in their final draft stage almost very quickly. Whereas I've other stories that I really like as well, but where they were 4 and 5 years on a succession of different laptops in various conditions of distress, you know, for years before you figured out what was wrong. You can be very dumb about your own work as a story writer. You can't see it's false for years because you're so close to it. Mm-hmm. But my absolute favorites of mine, I think, have felt like gifts. They've come very quickly inside a very short burst of time, and that's a real buzz compared to the long lonely haul of a novel or a script or whatever it is.
And favorites of others, not to embarrass you by asking you who is your favorite child, as in which is your own favorite short story of your own. What about other authors, Kevin?
I've just been rereading a collection from the late 80s by James Salter, a collection called Dusk. And there's a story in there called American Express. Two sharp young New York lawyers pull a bit of a scam, make a lot of money, go on a long road trip through Europe. They take up with a dangerously young Italian girl. And it's a story about the way that evil really can bring itself into a life in an almost casual way, and a warning about how we need to watch ourselves all the time. Incredibly powerful story writer, beautiful, glamorous, lyric, elegiacal quality to his sentences, put a real heft of feeling always coming off the page with Salter.
Who are the writers that stand out for you in that respect, Chris Morris?
Oh, so many. I mean, Mary Lavin, I think, is just stunningly good. I mean, she writes about grief like nobody else, and she can distill that kind of moment when grief sneaks up on you and grabs you in a line. And I think, you know, going back to, you know, what is the thing we look for in the short story? So many of the great short stories have great final lines, that it comes down to this line at the end that you remember in a way you don't remember others. But, you know, I mean, there's great writing. James Baldwin. James Baldwin, you know, is just this amazing voice coming from Black America in the 60s. You know, plays novels like, short stories like Going to Meet the Man or Sonny's Blues. Just incredible stories.
And I think for most people in this country, if you say a short story, and indeed I think you'd probably agree with this yourself, Chris, you know, The Dead, James Joyce's The Dead will immediately spring to mind. But it brings up that thorny question of, you know, when is a short story not a short story? When is it something else? When is it a novella? When is it, you know, heading in that direction? Is it hard to pin down that definition, and is it a kind of a waste of time in some ways?
Yeah, I mean, Edgar Allan Poe once defined short story as a work of fiction you could read in a single sitting. So there's a bit of flexibility there. It depends on how long you can sit. But I mean, The Dead, I mean, I always feel a bit uneasy. I mean, if you ask my favorite short story of all time, I would say The Dead. And I would feel guilty because I'm not quite sure. It's not quite almost a novella, but I can read in a single sitting, so I'll take it. But it has that great last line, you know, that final sentence there where, you know, his soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe and faintly falling like the descent of their last end upon all the living and the dead. I mean, yeah. Wow.
That last line aspect is quite interesting when it comes to the short story, really, Kevin Murray, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you make your way towards that, or have you, you know, can you know the destination when you're starting out, if you know what I mean?
I've often come up with the last line first, and then that's a great feeling when you do that because you have a map, you know, you have a destination, and you're just kind of working yourself into all sorts of contortions on the page just to earn that last line, you know. It's weird sometimes. I've had, you know, a title for a story way before I've had characters or a setting or anything else or events for it. But I've just, I knew for ages I wanted to write a story with Ox Mountain in its title somewhere, and I eventually found a way to do it. So it's peculiar what's a long story and what's a novella. You know, there are 90-page stories that feel like long stories, and there are 90-page novellas that feel like novellas. It's a very kind of it's a very difficult distinction, and it's something about scope and it's something about feeling.
Interestingly enough, I suppose my feeling has always been that as a country we seem to have a particular affinity to the short story. Have you any theories as to why that might be, Kevin?
I don't know. I think we kind of overstate this a little bit in truth. You can't say there aren't great English, French, German, Russian,
to be fair,
Canadian story writers. We've had sort of, I guess, just for the sheer size of the island, we've probably punched above our weight. But there are great stories all over the shop. I've been reading. I wrote an introduction to a new selection of Julio Cortazar's stories, so Argentinian stories from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and was amazed by how fresh they feel, how contemporary they feel, beautiful kind of twisted takes on reality, very spiky humour. So he's another one I'd be pushing at the minute.
And just as we finish up this discussion around that form then, Chris, I know you have a theory around the idea of the nature of Irish society, the fragmented nature of Irish society, and the nature of the short story itself.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't claim it completely personally, but it's an idea that's been around for a while. That is that when you believe that you can see how all the pieces work and fit together, you write novels. So you get Middlemarch in the middle of, you know, 19th century England, where there's a belief you can see the whole thing fit together. When you don't have that conviction, you either write short stories or you write novels like Ulysses that are already broken up into pieces. Mm. And I think there's a certain truth to that, because I think now we don't have a sense that we know how all the pieces fit together. And I get a sense that when a novelist sits down to write, and Kevin can tell me whether I'm right or wrong on this, today there's almost a sense of trying to figure out what a novel is with each new novel. And in some ways, the short story is the kind of fiction that fits into that world. You write these little shards.
Yeah, is the novel more, I suppose, adaptable in that sense, Kevin? Maybe the short story a more fixed form?
I don't know. I mean, in terms of experiment and trying to find new places to bring a story, I think it's an ideal medium in a way for experiment, because you don't waste 2 years on an experimental novel that doesn't work out, that goes nowhere. You might lose a week, you know, when your experiment trips off the desk and busts its neck on the floor. But I think the novel, or the short story rather, can tend to a kind of conservatism sometimes, because it's such a beautiful form in the way that build, it's that closing line and that sort of fall away, fade out that a great ending gives you. You know, it brings a kind of a sense of convention and sometimes into the story form. But there's great experimental work going on in the story as well.
Now, listen, thanks to both of you for sharing your thoughts on the short story form, Kevin Barry and Chris Morrish. And after the break, we will be looking at the 10 shortlisted stories on this year's RTE Short Story Competition. And welcome back to this special arena, where we will be announcing the winners of the top prizes in the RTE Short Story Competition in honour of Francis McManus. Nearly 2,800 entries this year, which were whittled down to a shortlist of 10. All 10 stories will be broadcast in a series starting later tonight here on RTE Radio 1. With me now are the judges for this year's competition, writers Declan Hughes and Lisa McInerney, with me here in studio, and author Lucy Caldwell, who joins us on the line from Kent, I do believe. All 10 writers who are shortlisted tonight are tuning in. I wonder how serene or how nervous those particular 10 people are on this Monday evening. Around the country, some of them abroad as well, and they're waiting to hear who the overall winner is. But before that, let's hear from some of the short stories. We get a flavour of all of them, I hope. Briefly, I'll list the stories. Don't take anything from this listing. Alphabetical order by title. That's the way I've sorted them out. They're all available to read on rte.ie/culture, by the way. And a reminder, they'll be broadcast over the next 2 weeks on late date, RTE Radio 1, 11:20 p.m. every weeknight. Over the next 2 weeks, you can hear the 10 short stories. So here is the list, alphabetical order by title. A Heart Like That from Paul Boyle. Mammo by Sarah Keating. Muddlers by Grainne O'Hare. People Over There by Doa Baker. The Johns by Rachel Walsh. The Night Call by Helen O'Neill. The Pangs by Paul Linehan. The Third Day by Kevin Donnellan. We Must All Be Kind by Hugo Kelly. Windsea by Donal Minahan. Congratulations to all 10 shortlisted writers. I suppose, Lisa, you know, when you enter a competition, even to get to this stage of being one of the 10 shortlisted writers, that's already a phenomenal achievement. This is not an easy form to write in.
Oh, God, no, absolutely not. And to be honest, we were just saying before we came into studio here that just to get to this point is just must be just so validating for everybody to just feel the permission to kind of go and you're doing the right thing. Here's, I mean, there was nearly 3,000 entries. So everybody, congratulations to the shortlist. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. And by the way, I should have said earlier that we're live streaming this evening's show, available via the RTE website, rte.ie/radio. And you can watch the live stream there, all of so available on the RTE Culture site. That's rte.ie/culture. You talked, Declan, about a kind of an anxious and an unsettled country that you were picking up from the stories that you read. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, there's a sense that, and particularly a lot of the stories put characters under sudden stress. And I think we've all gone through a sudden stress.
For sure.
And the words that come to mind are unravelling, you know, regrouping, characters looking for meaning in their past or a sign towards the future. And I thought it was symptomatic of, not to sound too windy, but where we are, and they're picking up the current. There's a thrum of unease that percolates almost every story.
So not necessarily direct and face on, but kind of it's there bubbling away underneath. And and Lucy Caldwell joining us from Kent this evening. At the last time you were on with us, Lucy, we were speaking about your own short story collection, Intimacies, published by Faber earlier this year. And one of the stories from that, All the People Were Mean and Bad, has recently been nominated for the BBC Short Story Award. So congratulations on that. Judging a competition as opposed to being part of a competition, how different is that? Does it give you insights, in fact, would you say, Lucy, in terms of your own writing?
Thanks, Sean. Yeah, the first thing that I should say is it was such a delight to judge it with Lisa and with Declan, both writers that I admire and both such good writers on writing. You know, there was such a high volume of entries and we spent hours and hours discussing various aspects of the craft, you know, from the overall sweep of a story to the single sentence. It's interesting. One of the things I love about the Francis McManus Award is that it celebrates stories that are written to be listened to as well as just read on the page. And so you're reminded, you know, on that technical side of things, things like pace become so important on radio. You know, the reader's at the writer's mercy. You can't skim ahead or slow down. The writing has to do that. You know, that sense of pace, rhythm has to be so perfect. You know, the short stories need that sort of propulsive force, which it can come. It doesn't have to be plot. It can be the sense of a character, the sense of a voice. But writing for radio, I think it is more challenging than something that just has to work on the page.
Yeah, certainly the aural side of it is important, Declan Hughes.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. And each story was very attentive to that. And then the work the actors did to bring the stories alive was absolutely phenomenal. And often pointed to areas that, however closely we read, you know, it just highlighted a thing and you think, how did I not spot that?
Yeah. When you hear it spoken, I was talking about this earlier on, about this idea of the oral form. That's hugely important, I think, when you're writing for radio like this, Lisa.
Yeah, I mean, it should be important whether you're writing for radio or writing just for yourself, because I feel like a story comes alive when you read it out loud to yourself. When you're editing, you need to know how something hears. And I don't know if that harkens back to the fact that we have this oral tradition, but certainly for me, I need to hear it.
It's a great way to measure if you've done anything wrong as well. You'll hear the repetitions.
The minute you say it out loud.
The dead weight, absolutely.
Yeah, I should say, by the way, that this competition is 35 years old this year, originally set up to honour the writer and broadcaster Francis McManus. Shortlisted writers in the past include Claire Keegan, Liz Nugent, Neil O'Connor, Chris Binchy, Daniel McLaughlin, Austin Duffy, and this year, in fact, two novels and a short story collection, Sarah Gilmartin, Mel Doherty and Stephen Walsh, respectively, with those three books. Those three writers were shortlisted in the competition in the past 3 years, so it must be a signifier of something to be on this shortlist for sure, if not just simply quality writing. Right, let's start off by listening to some of the stories then and talking a little bit about them. We'll start with the first of this year's story. Dervla Crotty is the reader here, and she's reading from the opening of A Hurt Like That by Paul Boyle.
Claire didn't know that she was unhappy. Not really. Not until they'd strapped her in and wheeled her out head first. She'd left with the provocative squeal of those little grey wheels that she'd first seen from the floor when they'd stopped a couple of inches from her nose and settled impatiently, rocking almost imperceptibly back and forth. They'd smelt incongruously of rubber and hospital and dog shit all at the same time. Was there nothing not smeared with it, dipped and rolled in the bacterial olfactory stew of it? The scent of life itself, present at all the comings and the goings.
Dermot Crotty there reading from Paul Boyle's story, A Heart Like That. Declan Hughes, I was speaking with Chris Morris and Kevin Barry about the importance of the end line of a short story earlier on. Really, Paul gets the opening line there, doesn't he? Claire didn't know that she was unhappy.
Yeah, it's fabulous. I mean, this is an example of the unravelling story subgenre. It's a woman who falls off, I'm not sure if it's a chair or a ladder, painting her ceiling and her walls, and she just spins back and forth through her life, back to leaving cert poetry she can remember, forward to the husband she resents for not being the type of guy who would paint, but that's the reason that she married him in the first place, because he wasn't
one of those guys,
alpha practical guy. And so it free ranges. It's got this brooding intensity that's really intoxicating.
And a heart like that, Declan mentioning leaving, she goes back to leaving cert poetry, a line from Sylvia Plath there from her poem Poppies in July. Is that important, or is that just a nice little detail, or what does it add to the story, would you say, Lisa?
I don't know if it's not even something I think that jumped out at me at all. These things are all little bonuses, I think, really, and it kind of fills out the literary world or something like that. But I mean, they're not really necessary. I mean, I don't think that it depends on you being able to get a specific reference for you to enjoy the story.
Yeah, for sure. Let's move on then to Hugo Kelly's We Must All Be Kind. We're clearly in lockdown in this story. We encounter a man who's struggling a bit, to say the very least. His washing machine has broken, so he started dressing in his late father's suits on his Zoom calls, remember those? And now he's been reprimanded from doing so. Let's hear some of We Must All Be Kind by Hugo Kelly at a point where the narrator gets a call from Hannah in HR, and the reader here is Ronan Leahy.
I tried to explain that I did like wearing the suits because they helped me leave work behind when I took them off in the evening. Otherwise, there was nothing but work to fill my days. Hannah muttered. She thought deeply for a second before speaking. We need to be kind, she said. Her voice rose ever so slightly as she spoke. We must all be kind. Could you, you know, just hand wash a fleece or a hoodie or something?
We must all be kind. Hugo Kelly's story read there by Ronan Leahy. And Lucy Caldwell, the word kind there, it's very loaded, isn't it, really, in the way, and certainly the way Hannah from HR uses it.
Yes, it is. We like this story from the title. That's such a good title for a story. And it was one of the only stories that was very, very much set in this immediate present that we've all been living through. A lot of the stories, you know, they could have been set a couple of years ago or, you know, 5 years ago. But this one was very much pandemic and Zoom. And it was really nice to see that. It's very, very hard, I think, to write about the immediate present with no distance, no reflection. But it is one of the things that maybe a short story can do. You know, it can be a very fleet and responsive form.
Yeah.
And so we liked, you know, we really liked that about this story, with its very loaded sense of kindness.
Yeah, and Hugo doesn't take an obvious route through this to the end, Declan, really, does he, in terms of where he brings us with our narrator?
No. It gets perhaps increasingly eccentric. But I like the edge it has. But,
yeah.
But we must all be kind. Please be kind. Generally means do what I tell you to do.
Do what I want.
And agree with me. Yes, especially on the internet.
All right, let's move on. This is the only story, in fact, on the shortlist this year which is set outside of Ireland. People over there, by Doa Baker. Sura is the character here. She grew up in Ireland. She's visiting her cousins in Iraq for the first time, and they're keen to hear about life in Ireland.
Do the women go to pubs? What are the men like over there? Why do you have that monobrow? Is that the fashion? Sura forgets about the car bomb. Yes, the women go to pubs. Not Sura, of course. She accidentally entered the student bar at university once and everyone had stared. She only knows Irish men from a halal distance, and she doesn't touch her eyebrows because she's hoarding her vanities for after she secures a husband.
And that's a little section there from People Over There, one of the 10 shortlisted stories on this year's RTÉ Short Story Competition, and that shortlist. And it's the only one, as I said, that is set outside of Ireland. And I'm delighted to be joined on the line right now by Doa Baker, the author. Doa, you actually grew up in Dublin of Iraqi parents. So like the Sura in the story, you have a foot in both cultures. To what extent was that a spark for the writing of this story?
The story, but I do need to clarify that it is a piece of fiction. I didn't travel to Iraq and sabotage anyone's romance, but absolutely, I did draw from my own cultural background.
Did you have that experience in both places then, kind of this fish out of water feeling, which I think Sura experiences?
Absolutely. I think you've interpreted the story very well, because I grew up in Ireland not maybe feeling more Iraqi, and then by the time I travelled to Iraq, I realised actually I wasn't.
Yeah, and if you didn't realise it, I bet you were told it in both places that you weren't from either place. Well, listen,
right.
Congratulations on the shortlisting, Doa.
And, Thank you so much.
I'm delighted. Not at all. And Doa's story, People Over There. The relationship between the cousins and the conversations between the two cousins. Sura visits her cousin Mia. Mm. They're great pals until they're not great pals. It's very nicely handled, Lisa.
Yeah, it is. And there's something so recognisable about it. And this has really got to me as I was reading and then listening to the story. Is almost you can see this disappointment coming and how difficult this interaction is going to get. It's so familiar, and there's kind of this inevitability about it, not wanting to ruin anything, but it is just so recognisable.
It certainly is that. Right, so that said, that's another of our stories, Doa Baker's People Over There. With us this evening, Declan Hughes, Lisa McInerney here, and Lucy Caldwell joining us from Kent. We're talking about the 10 shortlisted stories for this year's RTÉ Short Story Competition. We'll move on now to the fourth story that we have for you, Mamo by Sara Keating. The character we were talking about earlier on, In a Heart Like That, we have real accesses here to internal thoughts. A character's incapable. She's pretty helpless. But she's a very different character here. She's a grandmother who is not so keen about visits from her grandchildren and their mother, Sally. The reader here is Ingrid Craigie.
I hear them coming, skipping down the corridor for the weekly pilgrimage, full of life and cheek for the nurses. Frisky little lambs. Then the plunged, insulting shush as they turn into my room and hover in the doorway until Sally up my loves them and they climb onto their plastic thrones to sit in silent, revolted judgment.
And that was Ingrid Craigie reading a section there from Mamo by Sara Keating. Lucy, we were talking earlier again with Chris Morrish, and it was Kevin Barry who talked about intensity as being one of the very important aspects of a short story. Certainly intensity in this one, and that last word that we heard in that clip, vitally important to the story, judgment. There's a lot of judgment going on.
Yeah, there is such an intensity to this story. Yeah, I'm sure Irish listeners in particular will hear that we're in Ballyagongoira territory here, with the grandmother and the intergenerational, you know, the ferocity of those fraught relationships, made all the more searing by, I think this is a particularly brilliant reading of this story by Ingrid Craigie. You know, it's crisp, it's clear, it's restrained. This is one of the stories that, you know, rather than being a sort of traditional third person past prose, this story is more akin to a dramatic monologue. So we're in that medium of, you know, internal monologues and unseen ghostly voices and slippages and overlayings and all those things that radio can convey so brilliantly.
That intensity is there within that. And Sarah manages here as well to give us a character we couldn't call Mamo likeable, could we, Lisa? And is that important? It's always a question that comes up. Can, you know, do I like the character or do you not like the character?
Oh God, it's not not important at all, as long as the character is interesting, and Momo is always interesting. Unpleasant characters can be so much fun to write, to read, and hear, to listen to. And what's great about her is like that judgmental, or for me, she almost kind of became like a personification of 20th century Ireland and all of this kind of like the stuff that we'd like to leave behind. And at the same time, she's so vulnerable as well. So she's fascinating.
Yeah, and I think the daughter has a great, Sally, the daughter has a short story of her own sitting in there somewhere in Declan, doesn't she? She's quite the invention too.
Yeah, she specialises in avoidance, in anger management of them. Yeah.
All right, that's Mamo by Sarah Keating, another one of our short listed stories this evening. Windsea is our next story by Donal Minahan. We're dealing with a character here who's really is hanging on by his fingertips to his place in society. Just set the scene for us, if you would, for this one, Lucy.
It's got a brilliant opening line. We've been talking quite a lot about opening lines. It's got such a good opening line. And it's another, dramatic monologue piece. You'll hear it's such a tour de force performance by Erin Monaghan. It's not the sort of interiority. It has kind of like reluctant fundamentalist style, the Mohsin Hammed novel. Mm. It has a presumed you. The whole monologue is directed to this you, and as the piece goes on, this you's situation becomes dramatically clear. I'm trying not to give any spoilers
here.
Yes,
for sure, for
your listeners. But I don't know if I'm allowed to quote the first line, if we're going to be hearing that.
No, we're not going to hear the first line, so you can quote it, because that's the first thing people will read if they go to the RTE website.
It starts off with, "I know Hobo looked scary as fuck, but he was a good dog."
And Hobo was a dog. And we're not going to hear about Hobo in this section, or do we? I can't remember now. But this is a little bit further into the story, and the presumed you is being spoken to directly here by the Erin Monaghan character. Yeah, I'm calling him the Erin Monaghan character, the narrator of the story, Windsea by Donal Minahan.
I could have seen myself staying in this place. The ma too, maybe. She'd got a job as a classroom assistant in the Steiner School in the local town. Loved it, so she did. I hadn't bothered enrolling into another school. F's all the way in the junior cert, and had only another couple of years left, and no point wasting everyone's time going after a leaving cert, because everyone knew I wasn't going to do nothing with books.
And that's Erin Monaghan reading from Windsea by Donal Minahan. And Donal is on the line this evening. People talking, Donal, about this idea of almost the dramatic monologue. Did you think of it in that way? It's very hard not to hear it that way when you hear Erin Monaghan literally lifting it up off the page.
Oh, it's great to hear it there, actually, and a fantastic job by Erin Monaghan. Thanks very much. I have no idea where it came from. The voice just came to me. When you see something or someone and you just be wondering about them and daydreaming about them or that, when you should be doing something else. So I've had the uncle in my head for a few years, and it just came out one morning then, in one go.
And that's what I was going to ask you about. This was a story that you just sat down and out it came.
Yeah, like it usually starts with an image or something that gets large in your head, and you keep at it then until you free it by writing it down. I think we all know people like the boy and his mum. My heart goes out to them. They're doing their best, but they just struggle. And as Lucy's right, they're so close to the edge, so.
Yeah, because he's in a situation where he thinks he's going to be kicked out of yet another rental situation, and the mother, trying to look after his mother in the midst of all of that as well. Just for one final question on that, Donald, is it usual for you for the stories to come quickly like that, or do you have to tangle with them more in the usual run of events?
Yeah, no, I think like Kevin Barry said earlier on, it's really a privilege when it happens like that. It does happen sometimes. But yeah, no, it's definitely not the norm.
Well, listen, congratulations on the story. That's Donal Minahan. And Declan, cast of characters here. Hobo the dog. I mean, even the name Hobo, you kind of know who the dog is before you hear anything about him. The mother who's doing these Jimmy Oliver recipes to try to keep the landlord sweet.
The detail there with the mother doing the Jamie Oliver on her phone to get the apple pie going, and working in the Steiner School and reading the self-help books and continually questing to reinvent herself, and it just sort of gives a lie to any sense you might have, a cliched sense of the culture of those people, you know. Mm. So it's just, and it's that rhythmic surge, it's just irresistible to you follow through. And I can totally hear that sense when a writer gets, when you get hold of, you're lucky to get hold of a character with a voice, it just, it writes you. You know,
yeah, so we've had 5 of our 10 stories at this point, 5 of our 10 shortlisted stories at this stage. Just how important is that aspect, Lucy? You know, we kind of touched on it in a couple of the stories now where it, we do have the sense of a monologue. You can't approach every short story as if it were a monologue because some of them just won't fit that form, will they?
No, not at all. And as Kevin said, it was so interesting, Kevin Barry, it was so interesting listening to that discussion at the beginning. You know, sometimes like a plot is a really good propulsive mechanism through a story, a sense of voice, a sense of character, but I think it can also come from tone. You know, I've written stories where it's not the plot, it's not first person, it's not character, but it's all about the tone that you're trying to just adhere to through the story. And so I think, yeah, there are sort of There are so many different ways of doing it.
Yeah, and I suppose the monologue is often useful for an isolated character or a character who's very much looking into him or herself. But we also have stories on the shortlist that deal with very much with friendship and romance. And the one that we're about to listen to now is one of those. It's a story called The Johns by Rachel Walsh. And the reader here is Cathy Rose O'Brien.
Emma's kitchen is cramped but bright. The walls painted orange with blue tiles. A small windowsill is covered in plants. All 20 and 30-somethings nowadays keep plants because we can't afford children and landlords won't let us have dogs. But our need to give affection must go somewhere. If that's true, Emma is clearly overflowing with affection.
And that's a section there from The Johns, one of our shortlisted stories. Rachel Walsh, the author, and it was Cathy Rose O'Brien who was the reader in that. We get this burgeoning relationship and friendship between these two women, Lisa, but really, what really tickled me pink about this was what graffiti, I don't know if it was a starting point for the author, but graffiti plays a big role, including graffiti in Pompeii.
Yeah, and like this is what I love this technique that is used in the story. So when you have a protagonist like Jen, who I found to be, she's quite introverted, she's quite, you know, she's unsure of herself, she's a very observational person. So her way of almost contextualizing her feelings is to drop in these details about the world based on first something she sees along the street and then other things that she knows as she tries to work out her feelings and what she might do next. So I thought I loved it.
And a real delicacy here in this story as well, Declan. I was saying as we were listening to the clip, you just think at any moment if anybody puts a foot wrong here, the whole thing could become a mess.
Yeah, but it's also got a kind of poise, a sort of almost an elegance and a whimsical ease to it where it takes its time and you feel it's just paced very, very nicely. Mm.
Let's move on then to a story called Muddlers, featuring, again, female friendship very much at the heart of this. Grainne O'Hare is the author. Ali White is the reader here. And be prepared for a very good history lesson.
Martha is regularly reprimanded in lessons for encouraging debate around which Irish revolutionary is the biggest ride. Sir, tell me honestly that you wouldn't risk it all for a night with Maud Gonne? Their history teacher refuses to engage in this discourse, although Martha notes he has several sepia-toned photographs of Constance Markievicz in military uniform and feathered hat taped to the side of his filing cabinet, like pin-ups in a teenage locker.
And that's Ali White reading a section there from Muddlers. I'm tempted to open a competition around Martha's characterisation of Irish revolutionaries, trying desperately to avoid having to reuse the phrase. She has a lot of fun with history here, Declan.
Oh yeah, this is great, almost Derry Girls style exuberance. Mm. These are two, you know, fast talking, sharp talking, smart girls.
Martha and Kate, isn't it? Yeah.
Finish each other's lines, dialogue, and it's got great energy. They talk about shit disco is the disco they go to. All these little coded exchanges and references. It's got a gleefulness, and there's again a dark undercurrent different, but I cherish it for its joy, really.
Yeah, and it does take a dark twist, Lucy Caldwell, and we don't want to give anything away in that, but it kind of, as the past is revisited, difficulties have to be ironed out.
That's right. It's as Declan has said, it is so sharp and funny. It's really lovely to read a story that's friendship and young woman and, you know, pink flip phones and patchy S Club 7 towels. You know, the sort of joy in all of those details is brilliant. But yes, I think like a lot of the best stories, it is very comic and very fast and very short and very moving. And then the twist of the knife, you know, the dark, there is a definite darkness there towards the end of the story.
I
don't want to say anything.
Don't say anything more about it, because I have Grainne O'Hare actually on the line, joining us from the UK. In fact, Grainne, I want you to explain Muddlers first of all, if you would, Grainne, and your own fascination with history, particularly the United Irishmen, it would seem.
Yeah, well, the Muddlers Club was the sort of name that the United Irishmen used as a kind of code whenever they were meeting and planning all their rebellions and everything. And I kind of, I think in the first lockdown, I was taking lots of walks around Cave Hill, and I sort of was like, I really want to base a story around this. And so started looking into what happened here like 200 years ago. So started reading a lot about them. And then really wanted to kind of translate that sense of loyalty and fellowship kind of into a friendship in the 21st century.
Okay, well, listen, congratulations on the shortlisting. That's Grainne O'Hare, author of Muddlers. It's Story This Evening, The Third Day by Kevin Donlan. Sport at the very heart of this one. Our narrator is a senior medal winner, wants to prolong celebrations long after his teammates have called it a day. The reader here is Ina Hardwick.
I had drank the fourth pint a bit slowly because of the food, and I was starting to feel like maybe my worries were coming back, so I headed back towards Dwyer's. Didn't like being back outside because it was kind of dark, even though it was lunchtime. And I thought, feck you, Decky. Because he had gone on about winning and summer hurling, and he was full of shite because he knew full well we never finished senior championship before October. And the dark made me think of dusk and how I didn't like dusk because it was ominous, and I thought about how ominous the dusk would seem the next day after 3 days and the drink.
And that's Ina Hardwick reading the third day. Amazing, Lisa, how in this story, we're all fun, we're all down the pub, we're having loads of pints, and then suddenly this melancholy, this loneliness creeps in Kevin Donlan's story.
Yeah, I mean, and it's heightened then by just how familiar this guy is. I've met this guy, I've met iterations of this guy, you know, the guy who's kind of feeling a little bit left behind, a little bit out of sync, and knowing that it's his fault, it's something that he's done to himself. This is a great exploration of kind of self-defeat and delusion.
All right. You know? Let us move on to a second last story then on the shortest, The Night Call by Helen O'Neill. This is read by Jane Brennan. And Helen O'Neill herself was a GP who did night calls. And this, unfortunately, is just the aftermath of a road accident with a dog. And this is the section of the story where we pick up.
He paused before he injected and, leaning in to stroke the softness of the dog's domed head, he crooned a lullaby of reassurances into the dropping ears. Then, as the column of thick white liquid slipped into the vein, we could hear the countdown rising ever louder from the house. 4, 3, 2, 1! The dog's broken body relaxed, and his eyes closed slowly.
There we go, The Night Call, the story there by Helen O'Neill. And lovely the way Lucy Caldwell that story links into a New Year's Eve night. Very cleverly done.
Yeah, you can hear this story is very good on mood. It has that confident, simple, direct narration, you know, beautifully done by Jane Brennan. There are no pyrotechnics in this story in terms of voice or in terms of plot, but it builds to this lovely tenderness. It's very good in the restraint and warmth. You can hear these moments at stretch, you know, the 2 minute silence before declaring someone officially dead, or this horrible moment when you inject a dog with enough morphine to kill it and it doesn't die. It's really good on those moments.
We need to get going now to get to our last story, which is The Pines by Paul Linehan. A suburban couple become increasingly annoyed by their neighbour who insists on occupying his false balcony. They're very keen that we know it's a false balcony overlooking their garden. Norma Sheehan is the reader.
We stay indoors for a week and then May beckons.
Sunday mornings on the patio, skinny lattes and the supplements in sunshine, and we succumb. Only 5 minutes in, Tom nudges me. I know at once it's him. Him on his balcony, that's not. I refuse to look. Tom reads the reviews, and then I do look. I can't not. And I can see that this man is... It's broad daylight and he's peeing over the edge of his balcony. He's aiming at our garden but falling mercifully short. Tom! I warn. Tom looks again. That's it now, he says. I'm calling the guards.
Indeed he is. That's Norma Sheehan reading The Pines. What I want to say about this story is very funny as we get a sense of there, Lisa, but it really does twist and turn and your sympathies move around very easily and very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, there's such a sense of mischief in this story and it stays on just the right side of parody. And then all of a sudden, you're kind of unsettled by this kind of nebulous belligerence of this other, this neighbour. And you think to yourself, oh my God, what would I do in this situation? And there's no real answer.
No, there isn't. Okay, listen, we've been through the 10 short stories, 10 short shortlisted stories. We're coming back with the runners-up and winner after the... Okay, welcome back. Now is the time. 2,800 entries into the RTE Short Story Competition and 10 shortlisted. We've heard from all of them and all available on RTE Culture, rte.ie/culture, and you'll be hearing them on late date from this evening. Right, there's usually a first, second and a third. We're not doing that tonight, Declan Hughes. Please explain why.
Yeah, we decided to honour the extremely high quality of the entries by awarding 2 second prizes of €2,000 each. And so first joint second prize goes to a story that's poised, poignant, self-lacerating, a deeply moving incarnation of maternal love soured, of a fraught mother-daughter bond, of the ferocious tenacity of love elegantly and powerfully narrated, the whole infused by anxiety and fear, the fear of ageing, of the dying, of the light. With our congratulations, joint second prize of €2,000 goes to the writer of Mamo, Sarah Keating.
And Sarah is on the line. Congratulations, Sarah. I think everybody loved the story. Just tell us a little bit, if you wouldn't mind, about the genesis of this this granny and her not so much her great love for her grandchildren. It was a throwaway remark that you heard, I believe.
It was, yeah. First of all, just thank you so much for reading. Thank you. It was just something that my mother said, and it just stuck with me and it kind of settled in my head for a very long time. I don't know, 3 months I was walking around and I just kept on hearing, oh, I can't stand them. And I'd actually never written a short story before, but it was kind of one of my New Year's resolutions was that I wanted to write something short because I just get too invested and it takes me a really long time to write long work. And I said, this voice, I just followed it and that was Mamo.
Yeah, and it became Mamo's voice. Lisa, we need to go on then to the other joint second prize.
Yeah, this story's secrets are revealed to us with heartbreaking efficiency. The author allows its wounded protagonist room to rage, to mourn, and to justify a terrible deed, which makes this story as moving as it is compelling. And Aaron Monaghan captures perfectly the howl of a young man driven to the edge. I am delighted to announce that joint second prize of €2,000 in this year's competition goes to the author of Wincy, Donal Minahan.
Donal Minahan, I bet you weren't expecting a call back, Donal. You thought, they're rid of me now that they've called me once. Congratulations, Donal. I'm sure you're delighted.
Wow, yeah, no, it's brilliant. It's and I'm really, I know it's kind of weird. I'm really happy for the people in my story that they
there you go.
Great.
Well, congratulations, Donal. And let's go to Lucy Caldwell then for the big and final announcement for this year. Lucy?
Well, our winning story, it was a favourite of mine on the page and my instinct was confirmed hearing the actor's reading. He brings a real melancholy to it, but you can tell the fun he's having with it too. The writer is so attuned to the rhythms of speech and most brilliantly to the way group chats work. It's always so tricky, especially on the radio when the listener has no control over speed, to get the right balance between a conversational tone and a propulsive plot. And this story manages it effortlessly. And it's also really, really funny. Mm. It's a nuanced and searing look at a particular sort of masculinity and that age-old Irish devil, the drink, with a fresh and contemporary twist. So for all of these reasons, and with our huge congratulations, first prize of €3,000 in this year's RTE Short Story Competition 2021 in honour of Francis Manus goes to Kevin Dodlan for his story, The Third Day. Congratulations.
The Third Day, Kevin Dodlan. Kevin is on the line right now. Congratulations, Kevin.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I hope you're not going to follow Shane's activities here. Shane goes to the pub and kind of gets lost there. We meet him on the third day, and it looks as if he's going to be staying there for longer than that. I presume you'll have a sober recollection and reflection on your successes, I hope, Kevin.
Yeah, with two kids at home, I think I'd be lucky to get a first day.
Well, listen, with two kids at home then, is it hard to get time to sit down and do that writing?
I've started doing kind of short story writing over the last year, and you definitely have to be very regimented with when you fit the writing in, but I guess also you're quite focused of, oh, I'm going to make this 20 minutes or 40 minutes count, compared to maybe in my childless years, letting an entire day go by where I intended to write and it just didn't quite come off. So, there's six of one, really.
Well, listen, congratulations, Kevin, and congratulations on the story. I think everybody that has read and listened has really enjoyed it. That's Kevin Donlan, the winner of this year's RTE Short Story Competition in honour of Francis McManus. Kevin Donlan's story, The Third Day, read by Ina Hardwick. You heard a little bit of it earlier on. You can hear it in full tonight at 11:20 as part of Late Date with Cathal Murray. The rest of the shortlist will be broadcast every weeknight over the next 2 weeks at the same time. You can find out the schedule on rte.ie/culture. Congratulations to Kevin and the two runners-up, Sarah Keating and Donal Minahan. A reminder that all of the short stories are available to read on the website as well, and you can listen to them on Late Date. But that is it from our special programme on the RTE Short Story Competition. Thanks to the judges, Lucy Caldwell, Declan Hughes, Deesa McInerney, and to our colleague, the producer of the RTE Short Story Competition, Sarah Binchy. The broadcast coordinator this evening was Janice Furphy. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan and Sarah Binchy. Back with you tomorrow night at 7.